Well, today we're going to start our study of 1 Samuel in earnest. We had an introduction last week, and we found that 1 Samuel is part of a four-book set of Holy Scriptures consisting of 1 and 2 Samuel along with 1 and 2 Kings that originally were just one large unified book. And it was when the translation of the original Hebrew scriptural documents into Greek occurred that this process of dividing the Hebrew book of kingdoms ultimately into four books began. Now, don't think of this division process as a negative any more than the eventual division of books into chapters and chapters into books, verses was some kind of a corruption. It wasn't. It was only for convenience sake. It was for a better means to communicate and study God's word that these modifications were made. It caused no harm. The result of this Hebrew to Greek translation that took place in Alexandria, Egypt, around 250 years before the birth of Christ, was a work that came to be called the Septuagint, or LXX, which in Roman numerals is 70. It was actually a good and faithful translation, but as you have seen in our many Torah class lessons of the earlier books of the Old Testament, there are always questionable choices that a translator must necessarily make when translating a document from one language to another. And much of the issue of inherent translation difficulties is based on the rather simple and self-evident reality that a culture and its accompanying native language are tightly woven together, and they're inseparable. It's but a historic fact that the leaders of conquering empires have generally moved very rapidly to require that the usage of their own native language becomes imposed upon these newly conquered people, because if you can destroy the national language, you can disconnect the people from their own national identity. Once you do that, the assimilation process is faster, it's easier, and in but one or two generations, resistance to this new political reality is all but forgotten, except among a few radicals, perhaps. The reason for this is easily seen. Every culture develops traditions, and it recalls their own unique history by memorializing it, handing it down generation to generation. A few millennia ago, this handing down process was accomplished exclusively by word of mouth. Later on, these traditions were handed down using alphabets in writing. Certain culture and societal concepts were and are unique to that culture alone. And whatever the developed language used, words were invented to describe and communicate these concepts among themselves. For instance, the word and concept of democracy has a certain meaning in America, but quite another in England. Another one yet in France, and it's wholly different in modern Israel. Democracy in America has been historically and culturally based on an intense individualism, but in France, it's based on an equally intense collectivism. In modern Israel, democracy is a very unique blend of theocracy and socialism, even communism, and representative government that has a strong authoritarian thread that runs all through it. Thus, when we leave America and we visit one of these other so-called democratic countries, we can be pretty surprised at how differently they comprehend democracy as opposed to what we might think of it. So when we look at the Bible in English and we read a word or a phrase that is easily recognizable to us, while it may seem on the surface to be communicating the same concept in our Western society that the original Hebrew writer had in mind, quite oftentimes it is not. The same problem arose when the very first translation of the Hebrew Bible to another language, to Greek, was attempted. And I don't think it's very hard to imagine how some Hebrew cultural and traditional concepts just weren't carried across this language barrier in their fuller and more accurate sense. But now complicate it further by taking the Greek, translate it now to English. Or take the Greek and translate it to Latin and then to English. And the problem of further losing the original biblical cultural perspective at each step multiplies. Lose the original cultural perspective, and the all-important meaning can get lost right along with it. See, that problem doesn't get any easier for us in studying these next four books of the Tanakh. We're going to perhaps look at more Hebrew words and their nuances than we ever have. Okay. We're going to look closer at the nuances of the words and how it ever so slightly but importantly changes from what we usually take it to mean. We're also going to put to work what we've learned thus far from the Torah. Because as we move along through the Old Testament, you see, it's assumed that the reader knows what came before it. That we're familiar with Israel's beginnings and their history, as well as all of God's laws and commandments that undergirds it all. So, here we go. Israel was not a unified nation at the time of Samuel. In fact, we can only speak of Israel as an entity in the most general kind of sense. Certainly not a unified body. Rather, Israel is now merely a loose conglomeration of tribes and their many clans, and warfare among these Israelite tribes and clans became all too regular and common as they vied for territorial dominance, which was the norm for tribal societies, but ought not to be for God's set-apart people. Now, such instability means that neighboring nations have a much easier time in attacking various areas of the promised land, because it's unlikely that unless a tribe that is currently at peace would see any self-interest in coming to the aid of a brother tribe that was under attack, their view was, why take the risk? And many of the Canaanite peoples and nations that were there when Joshua first led Israel into Canaan, well, they're still there. They're entrenched as ever. The Philistines are quite powerful at this time, but their influence is mostly in the southern and the central regions of Canaan, primarily along the Mediterranean coast and then a narrow coastal plain known as the Shephelah. Open warfare is not the norm between the Hebrew tribes of the south and the Philistines, although skirmishes do break out from time to time. Rather, the political situation is that the Philistines are anything but brutish barbarians. They're quite sophisticated. They use their power wisely. They prefer a kind of peaceful coexistence with the three or four southern and central Israelite tribes, provided that these Israelite tribes kowtow to Philistia. That they don't do things that their masters see as provocative or threatening. It's not at all that Israel was to declare downright allegiance to Philistia, only that they remain docile, that they accept the Philistines' dominance of the region, and that Israel didn't defame the Philistine gods. Instead, they showed respect to them. On the other hand, Philistia certainly had in mind that probably within another generation or two, if they played their cards right, they would become the de facto government over all of southern and central Canaan, including, of course, the Israelite tribes that lived there. And the question of who was in charge would just become a settled matter rather naturally, with limited bloodshed. So while the Lord had in the past sent a number of deliverers called shoftim, judges, to these various tribes of Israel to save them from these outright attacks and vicious oppressions of various foreigners, Israel was even more fragmented and vulnerable now than when God gave them their first judge, Othniel, some 300 years or so earlier. Even this special priesthood that God had established within Moses' own tribe, Levi, was entirely dysfunctional. It was barely operating. So into these dark circumstances, God would send a new kind of Savior to usher Israel into a new kind, at least a new kind for them, of role, of rule. And as always, Jehovah's purpose was to demonstrate his marvelous mercy by rescuing his people from a predicament that was of their own making. So let's read the opening chapter of the first book of Samuel. Samuel chapter 1. Page 298 if you're using a complete Jewish Bible. There was a man from Ramataim Tzophim in the hills of Ephraim, whose name was Elchanah, the son of Yeroham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuf, from Ephrath. He had two wives, one named Hannah and the other Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. This man went up from his city every year to worship and sacrifice to Adonai Zevot at Shiloh. The two sons of Eli, Hophni, and Pichas were Kohanim of Adonai there. One day when Elchanah was sacrificing, he gave a portion of the sacrifice to his wife Peninnah and portions to each of her sons and daughters. But to Hannah, he gave a double portion because he loved Hannah, and even though Adonai had kept her from having children. Her rival taunted her, made her feel bad, because Adonai had kept her from having children. He did the same every year, and each time she went up to the house of Adonai, she taunted her so much she would cry, not eat. Her husband Elkanah said to her, Hannah, why are you crying? Why aren't you eating? Why be so sad? Am I not better to you than 10 sons? So Hannah got up after they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh. Eli the Kohen was sitting on his seat by the doorpost of the temple of Adonai, and in deep depression, she prayed to Adonai, and she cried, and she took a vow. She said, Adonai Tzevot, if you will notice how humiliated your servant is, if you will remember me and not forget your servant, but will give your servant a male child, I will give him to Adonai for as long as he lives. No razor will ever come upon his head. She prayed for a long time before Adonai, and as she did so, Eli was watching her mouth. Hannah was speaking in her heart. Her lips moved, but her voice couldn't be heard. So Eli thought she was drunk. Eli said to her, how long are you going to stay drunk? Stop drinking your wine. But Hannah answered, no, my lord, I'm a very unhappy woman. I've not drunk either wine or other strong liquor. Rather, I've been pouring out my soul before Adonai. Don't think of your servant as a worthless woman, because I've been speaking from the depth of my distress and anger. And then Eli replied, go in peace. May the God of Israel grant you what you've asked of him. And she replied, may your servant find favor in your sight. So the woman went on her way, and she ate, and her face was no longer sad. They got up early in the morning and worshipped before Adonai, and then returned and came to their house in Ramah. Elkanah had sexual relations with Hannah, his wife, and Adonai remembered her, and she conceived. And in due time she gave birth to a son whom she named Shmuel, because I have asked God for him. The husband, Elkanah, went up with his household to offer the yearly sacrifice to Adonai and fulfill his vow. But Hannah did not go up, explaining to her husband, "Not till the child has been weaned. Then I'll bring him, so that he can appear before Adonai and live there forever." Her husband Elkanah answered her, "Do what seems good to you. Stay here until you have weaned him. Only may Adonai bring about what he said." So the woman stayed behind and nursed the child until she weaned him, and after weaning him, she took him up with her, along with three young bulls, a bushel of flour, a skin of wine, and brought him to the house of Adonai in Shiloh, even though he was just a child. Now after the bull had been slaughtered, the child was brought to Eli. And she said, "My lord, as surely as you live, my lord, I am the woman who stood here near you praying to Adonai. I prayed for this child, and Adonai has granted the request I asked of him. Therefore, I too have loaned him to Adonai. As long as he lives, he's on loan to Adonai," and he prostrated himself there before Adonai. The story opens with identifying the region where our tale unfolds. And of course, it names the family it would center on. Now, the family is from a place called Ramataim Zophim, described as being located in the hills of Ephraim. Ramataim is a common place name. It means double hills, two hills. Ramat, hill, Aim, double or two. Thus, it's further identified as Zophim, which denotes just a clan's name, essentially giving us the place of two hills in the territory of Zuf. And later we'll see that this same man is said to be from Ramah, which is just a shortened version of Ramataim Zophim. So Ramah is a known place today. In fact, you can go there. You can visit the tomb of the namesake of this book of the Bible, Samuel. It's just outside Jerusalem. Now, the man from Ramah is the first character identified in this narrative, and his name is Elkanah, which means God created. And a short genealogy is given to help define his family, but at the same time, it also kind of confuses the situation a little bit, because it says that the clan leader of Elkanah's family was an Ephratite. And a few lessons ago, we learned that this term Ephratite can denote a couple of different things depending on its context. It can be synonymous with an Ephraimite, being of the tribe of Ephraim, or it can mean the person is from a village called Ephrat that's located just outside Bethlehem, or it can also mean a person who is from a clan of abundance, because Ephrat means fruitful. Or there's a fourth option. In our case, Elkanah was some combination of all those aforementioned possibilities. This is why, depending on the translator or the teacher, you will hear that Samuel is either a Levite, we'll get to that in a moment, or he's from the tribe of Ephraim, or he might even have been from the tribe of Benjamin, since the village of Ephrath is located in Benjamite territory. The genealogy given to us pretty well cements that Elkanah's father's family line was from the tribe of Levi. So from that sense, Samuel was for sure a Levite. In fact, we can go to 1 Chronicles 6, and there we'll get a much more complete family genealogy that connects Elkanah all the way back to Kohath, one of the sons of Levi. And in addition, we see that Elkanah was a customary name that was used within the Kohathite clan. But there is no denying that there is some additional family attachment to the tribes of Ephraim or perhaps Benjamin. It's possible that it is not a family attachment, per se, that's being communicated, but rather merely that this family of Levites resided in the territory of Benjamin or Ephraim, because after all, the Levites inherited no territory for their own, but rather were given cities to live in that were scattered throughout the 12 tribes. Now, verse 2 explains that this man Elkanah had two wives, Peninnah and Hannah, pronounced not like Hannah, but like Hannah. This means that Elkanah was reasonably well-to-do. By this time in Hebrew history, a man with more than one wife, more often than not, had two wives as much for a status symbol as anything else. Since in the Middle East, having an heir was critically important, a man might marry a second woman if his first wife couldn't seem to produce him a son quickly enough. And indeed it was that Peninnah produced an heir for Elkanah when Hannah couldn't seem to do that. Well, the story setup continues with the information that this pious family went up every year to Shiloh. We say Shiloh. All right, to observe some annual festival and to make a sacrifice. Now, there's a great deal of conjecture as to just what this festival might have been. Was it one of the three great pilgrimage festivals ordained in Leviticus? Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot? Or was it something else entirely? In fact, the evidence is that there were traditional private family or clan festivals that were held in Shiloh that had nothing to do with these Levitical feast days. That's probably the case here. Now, Shiloh was the location of the wilderness tabernacle at this time, and it was about 20 miles north of Jerusalem. The tent shrine of the Israelites had been there since the days of Joshua and remained there as the dwelling place of the Ark of the Covenant. Thus, the high priest was also located there. Eli was the high priest at this time, and his two sons were undoubtedly the chief priests directly underneath him. It is interesting that Phinehas and Hophni are both Egyptian names. They're not Hebrew. However, I doubt we ought to make too much out of this. It was kind of traditional to name some of each succeeding generation after folks from the previous generation, and we read about a man named Phinehas, a Levite during the days of Israel wandering out in the wilderness. So I'm pretty certain no inference to Egyptian loyalties is intended here. Now, we're told that Elkanah and his family went up to Shiloh annually to worship Yehovah Tzevaot, a phrase that is usually rendered in English as the Lord of Hosts. Now, there's a brand new title for the God of Israel intended here, and this is the first time in the Bible that we discover it. There is no evidence that before Samuel's time that it was in use. We're going to find it employed in three different forms or combinations from this point forward now in Holy Scripture. Elohim Tzevaot, which means God of Hosts. Adonai Tzevaot, which means Lord of Hosts. And Yehovah Tzevaot, which means Yehovah of Hosts. Well, so what does that title mean, Lord of Hosts? What's it trying to get across to us? Well, in Genesis, the term hosts is used in conjunction with two things, angels and stars. Notice in both cases, Tzevaot, hosts, plural, is speaking of heavenly hosts, or better, heavenly bodies. A host means something that's a multitude. It's a countless number. It's virtually synonymous with the biblical expression, as many as the sands of the seashore. So, at times, the Bible will speak of a host of angels or a host of stars. But when it does, the Hebrew word is not Tzevaot, but Tzeva. Now this is technical, but if you'll pay attention, this will give you a little biblical fact to impress and dazzle your friends with. When the Bible uses the term Tzeva, it's used like an adjective. That is, Zava, a host of stars. But we'll also find the Bible using a kind of shorthand form of the phrase that means the same thing. Rather than say, for instance, Zava Malachim, a host of angels, at times the Bible would just say Zevaot, meaning hosts, plural. That is, the word Zevaot just kind of stands by itself, and you won't see host of angels, just the term Zevaot. Thus, the word Zevaot encompasses the whole phrase. So when we see the word hosts, plural, just by itself, then it means a huge army of stars or a huge army of angels. It just depends on the context, which is which. Zeva is an adjective that explains a noun, star, like stars or angels. So Zevaot is a noun that is shorthand for a host of stars or a host of angels. Another common translation of Zevaot is heavenly hosts. Again, depending on the context, that could mean angels, it could mean stars. Could mean both. So when we see the three forms of Elohim Zevaot, Adonai Zevaot, Yehovah Zevaot, they're all alluding to the God who is both the God of the stars and the God of the angels, each of them innumerable in quantity. That's the sense of it. And of course, there is an interesting characteristic of stars and angels that we need to consider. Stars are physical objects. Angels are spiritual beings. Stars are visible. Angels are invisible. So this title for God that's expressed in three slightly different ways is this majestic expression meant to speak of the King and Master over all the seen and all the unseen. All of God's created creatures, all of God's created objects from any dimension. There's a lot behind those small Hebrew words. It's not so easy to bring across in a simple transliteration to another language. Now, verse 4 explains that Elkanah was up in Shiloh, making his annual sacrifice, and he gave a portion of this sacrifice to his wife, Peninnah, but he gave a double portion to Hannah. It says, because he loved her. And the sense of this, at least in English, is that he showed extra love to Hannah because she was unable to have children. That is, Elkanah felt sorry for her, so his heart went out to her. Further, that it was the Lord, who was keeping Hannah from having children. Interesting, more and more we're seeing this mindset that whatever happens, good or bad, to the worshiper of Yehovah, this is of the Lord. The Hebrews rightfully had no problem with this idea that the Lord could send catastrophe or he could send blessing to one of his own, according to his will. Thus, it wasn't with a blaming attitude that Hannah was saying that God had shut up her womb. It was just a matter of fact. It was with the simple understanding that nothing happens without the Lord's approval. So at the very least, God was approving of her barrenness. Now, I made this point, this last point, before we dissect this part of the verse, because it's kind of common Christianese to say that the Lord is in control of everything. And nothing happens without the Lord allowing it. On the other hand, it's the rather standard evangelical doctrine that nothing but good comes from the Lord. And he would never send something bad our way. So if something bad happens, it's the devil. Therefore, a lot of modern believers paint a picture of God that has him actively sending blessings, but passively standing aside and allowing calamities to happen. The Hebrews sure didn't see it that way. And this is because that's not what the Bible says about God. Here's how Hannah sees the nature of her problem, and as most Hebrew women of her time would have or should have seen it. The Lord actively and purposefully affected her body and thus made it so she could not have children. The reason for such a harsh choice might not have been knowable to Hannah, but she was comfortable that it was God's unassailable right to do it. And by the way, do you recall that Naomi, that aged and childless widow from the book of Ruth, made just such a statement expressing this same attitude, that it was the Lord who put her in such a bitter condition of poverty and hopelessness by means of the death of her husband and her two sons. See, to Hannah's thinking, there were two overriding reasons that might have accounted for her barren state. First, she had sinned, and this curse of childlessness was her punishment. Or, second, she had not sinned, but the Lord had his own undisclosed purpose for closing up her womb. Now, while I can't be 100% sure of which one it was, although there doesn't seem to be any kind of hint that sin was involved, Hannah also seems to be uncertain. She didn't know. And soon, when we untangle a couple more verses, we're going to see that Hannah suspects that maybe she did sin and is being punished, and she'd like divine restoration if that happens to be the case. Now, I'm not sure I have the ability to paint the scope of the humiliation and the pain in all this for Hannah. Not being able to give birth practically negated her role as a human female. She wasn't a whole woman. It was apparently the norm for the village women, at least some of them, in that era to poke fun, to make outright disparaging remarks at a barren woman because she was unable to perform the very thing she was born to do. And so that made her a lesser person. If that woman's husband wasn't wealthy enough to be able to marry a second wife, then he wouldn't have an heir, which means that his life essence would end at the grave and his family line would cease. And to the ancient mind, this was all the fault of the woman. These disastrous consequences lay solely at her feet. One can only imagine the terrible state of mind that a woman like Hannah endured. Now back to the top of verse 4 and this sacrifice that Elkanah was making. It had to have been a specific class or category of sacrifice called a zevah shlamim, because it was one of the few kinds that a worshiper could eat a portion of it. In fact, with this kind of sacrifice, the law gave the bulk of the sacrificial animal to the worshiper for food. But it also means that this wasn't the only kind of sacrifice that Elkanah would have performed. An olah and mincha were required before a zevah shlamim could even occur. But there's some other interesting aspects of verse 5, where our Bibles tend to say that Elkanah gave Hannah the double portion because he loved her. That's not quite correct. Rather, it ought to read, it was Hannah whom he loved. You see the difference? See, it immediately says he had love for Hannah, but something less for Peninnah, which is going to explain what comes a little later in our story. Thus, it is not that Elkanah necessarily felt sorry for Hannah and thus gave her an extra portion of meat from the sacrifice to make her feel better. Rather, it is he had great love for Hannah and not very much for Peninnah. It was favoritism outright. It was preference by Elkanah. a lot like we saw between Jacob and Rachel versus Jacob and Leah. In nearly every situation we'll read about in Scripture where a man has more than one wife or a concubine, we find trouble. Because it's just not in the human nature of women to accept being one of several in a man's household. And it's not in the human nature of men to love several women equally. Verses 6 and 7 tells us that Peninnah taunted Hannah for not having children, and this made Hannah feel bad. And every year, this whole messy, nasty scene was replayed because they'd all go up together to Shiloh for the family feast. And Elkanah would give a sacrifice, and he'd give Hannah her extra portion. And then Peninnah would retaliate by slinging, stinging words of derision towards Hannah for being childless. Now, this particular year, it so upset Hannah, she couldn't even eat her festive meal. She just wept and she wept. It was kind of a ironic situation that I'm sure Peninnah kind of delighted in. That Hannah couldn't enjoy this extra portion that her husband gave to her. I can only imagine what a difficult living situation it must have been for these two women, both of them legal wives of Elkanah. It would have been natural for jealousy to be front and center at all times, and for them to spar over getting what they perceived as their fair share of their husband's attention and his affections. So we see that in verse 6, Peninnah is even called Hannah's rival. All right, let's take a look at that for a moment. See, to translate the first part of verse 6 as saying that Peninnah was Hannah's rival is on course, but then it stops short. The Hebrew word is Sarah, and more recent understanding of the Ugarit language, which is a early Semitic cousin of Hebrew, well, it shows that this is actually an informal name for a kind of wife that was quite usual in ancient Middle Eastern society. It literally means rival wife or co-wife. In the larger sense, it can mean second wife, but not in the sense that one of the two wives was first and the other one is second. In this usage, both Peninnah and Hannah were Sarah, co-wives, literally equal wives of Elkanah. So although on the surface it seems as though the English text is telling us that the taunting was occurring because they behaved as rivals, in fact, the Hebrew explains that it's more akin to merely saying, oh, the other wife, without characterizing her behavior or attitude or whatever. Now, Elkanah, because he greatly loved Hannah, but not so much Peninnah, tenderly tried to soothe Hannah and rhetorically asked her why she was crying. He knew why she was crying. So he tried to get her to see the bright side. Men, we're good at that, aren't we? At all the wrong times, we try to help our wives see the bright side. Even though she could give him no sons, he treated her as wonderfully as a man could have treated a wife that had given him 10 sons, which is, of course, the one reason Peninnah had given Elkanah an heir, and that made her constantly miffed, because she's the one that provided the son. Now, Hannah was, of course, despondent, and by this time, she was going to take matters into her own hands. She was going to seek out the one who was causing her grief, see if something couldn't be done about it. So in verse 9, after the family finished their festive banquet meal, Hannah walks over to the sanctuary tent and confronts Jehovah in prayer. And Eli the high priest was sitting in his chair at the front entrance to the tabernacle. Of course, he noticed her. And a chair was an item of furniture in those days that was reserved for those of higher ranking, and it was considered a position of honor. A chair was not a usual piece of furniture. Most people that age merely sat on the ground or on a rock, or maybe if they're really lucky, a pillow. Hannah is weeping, and she begins her praying in front of the high priest, Eli. And we're told that she sort of made a bargain with God that was in the form of a vow. If God would relent, and open her womb, then she would return that child to God by means of dedicating him for sanctuary work for his entire life. Now let's carefully examine just what it is that Hannah said to the Lord. First, we need to remember, we need to give a lot of merit to Hannah for her coming to the Lord for refuge in her affliction. Now remember, she's not coming to Yahweh asking that he overrides some accidental biological problem with her body, or that the Lord overcomes some malicious act by Satan. She's coming to him asking him to relent and to release her from a condition that the Lord has intentionally put upon her for some unknown reason. Second, the reason for her requesting this favor from the Lord is to relieve her from her humiliation. In other words, this has nothing to do with anyone but herself. Her husband, Elkanah, has a vibrant bevy of children and at least one heir, thanks to the fruitfulness of Peninnah's womb. So there's no family or inheritance problem here that Hannah producing a child was going to solve. Rather, as we discussed earlier, it was life's purpose for a female to give birth. Thus, to be barren brought a never-ending sense of guilt and worthlessness to Hannah that no amount of double portions of food was ever going to replace. Thus, for Hannah, it wasn't necessary that she even raise this child, but merely to bring this new life into the world, which thereby fulfilled her womanly purpose and ended her humiliation. The bargain was that if the Lord would do this, then she'd give that child up to God as the one who gave this child to her. And not merely in figurative and spiritual sense, as we kind of do at baby dedications, but physically. Literally, she would remove the child from her motherly presence and give him over to the priesthood in service to Yahweh permanently. Now, I don't want to paint all vows as bargains. Many were simply promises to the father that asked nothing in return. But as we've seen many times, vows were often part and parcel with beseeching the Lord for some kind of specific deliverance. But I also think we need to understand that a vow made to God even as a bargain, oh, that's a serious matter. That's a serious thing to do. And Yeshua counsels against doing it. Not because it's sinful to make a vow, but because there can be unforeseen complications. A lot of unintended consequences of that vow. The vow that Hannah vowed was the vow of a Nazarite. And it was done in a similar mold as Samson's mother did, to have her shut-up womb revitalized, if you would. Both Samson and Samuel would become lifelong Nazarites, which was a rather rare occurrence biblically. A Nazarite vow was actually usually just for a specific temporary time. Now, some scholars say Samuel was not a Nazarite, and this was due to a couple of different lines of thought. First, Hannah did not say, she didn't use the word, that Samuel would become a Nazarite. She only said his hair wouldn't be cut. And second, it is questionable that a Levite would ever become a Nazarite. The whole idea of a Nazarite was that a member of one of the 12 secular tribes, all those other Israelite tribes, could assume a special status that enabled him to serve the Lord in a manner very similar to how the Levites served the Lord. See, Levites were automatically born with the right and the requirement to serve God at the tabernacle in some capacity or another. So it's kind of redundant, at the least, for Hannah to make a Nazirite vow on behalf of her Levite son-to-be, Samuel. However, keep in mind that this is a very good indication of this confused and dysfunctional era that we're talking about. And we don't even see an overt mention here that Elkanah was a Levite. We also see no evidence of Elkanah performing some kind of sanctuary service at the tabernacle in Shiloh, which all Levites were technically obligated to do. So again, using a baby dedication as an example, there's utterly no heavenly need for a parent to stand on a stage and have a pastor give the baby's life to the Lord. Every believing parent has the right to do that at any time, anywhere, without a formal ceremony or some church authority to preside. But a lot of young Christian parents don't fully comprehend that, so they go through the unneeded, but not at all wrong, step of participating in a formal baby dedication. Hannah may have been doing something kind of similar by dedicating Samuel to the Lord, when in fact his Levite heritage already gave him that special holy status required for sanctuary service all of his life. On the other hand, Levites were generally not required to begin their full-time sanctuary service until they were 25 years old. And then they were released from that duty by the age of 50. Early retirement. In our case, with Samuel, he would be the Lord's property right away due to Hannah's vow. And Samuel would begin to serve even as a small child. And then he would not be released at 50. He wouldn't be released until his death. So I have no doubts this was intended to be a Nazirite vow, whether it was appropriate, whether it was needed or not. Okay? That'll do it for chapter 1, and we'll continue it next week.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning, products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seed of Abraham Fellowship.